Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. After Germany surrendered, then Japan, that was the end of the fighting for World War II, but it was the beginning of the other part of the war, the occupation. American GIs had a new job, but it would sometimes be just as perilous as winning the war. We're joined by Susan Crothers, professor of history at Rutgers University and author of the book, The Good Occupation, American Soldiers and the Hazards of Peace. And Susan, welcome to The Source.
Thank you very much. I'm really pleased to be with you.
Our phone lines are open. We'd love to hear from our listeners. If you were part of the occupying force, either in Germany or anywhere in Europe and in Japan after World War II, what your experiences were, give us a call. The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. And Susan, you know, the movie and the book, A Bell for Adano, you write about that and about how that film and the book sort of cast the narrative as the good occupation. Talk about that some.
That's right. Well, I first became interested in the topic in 2002 to 2003 in the run-up to the launch of Operation Iraqi Freedom. And of course, the historical analogies with Germany and Japan were being repeatedly offered up as reassurance, validation in advance of the occupation of Iraq. And obviously, the intention was to reassure people that occupation would be reasonably easy. Sweets and flowers would be showered on occupation troops. And that set me wondering, since I was skeptical as to whether Americans at the time had really seen things that way, wondering what kinds of stories Americans were telling each other during and after the war about occupation. And I quickly discovered that John Hersey's novel, A Bell for Adano, which is set in Sicily as it's occupied in 1943, really formed the template and a very enduring template for Americans to reach more affirmative understandings of what occupation was all about. So a positive, democratizing intervention to rebuild societies that had been shattered by fascism, by bombardment, by the processes of war, and offer them a brighter future under American tutelage.
Now, I'd seen the movie, and I enjoyed it, and thought it was a good movie. And then I didn't know it came from such a significant book. I went ahead and ordered it on Amazon. It cost me one penny, so this is not an expensive read. And it's interesting how we had the occupation in Europe and in Japan, and we fought the good war, and we wanted to establish a better world out of the ruins. And this description of the events, this narrative, Hersey was a journalist, and he wrote the story for Life magazine sort of along these lines, and then he fictionalized it for his Pulitzer Prize winning book. And so apparently this narrative that he cast resonated very much so with the American people.
It certainly did, and the reason why you found a copy so cheaply is that this was a phenomenally successful book. There was an organization of the prominent figures in publishing during the war who called themselves the Council on Books in Wartime, and they bestowed what they called imperative status on the book, and they really went to town and marketed it very heavily, basically suggesting that every civic-minded American really ought to be reading this book and taking its moral to heart. And one of the many archives I went to as I was researching the book was to the Beinecke Library at Yale, where Hersey ended up his career. He was just 29 when he wrote the story you mentioned for Life, and then in just 6 weeks flat, dashed off this novel. And there are hundreds and hundreds of letters from school kids, from all sorts of people, including a letter from Albert Einstein, who apparently stayed up till 5 in the morning because he'd become so enraptured with Hersey's novel. And the protagonist of the novel, who's an Italian-American, who's particularly sympathetic to the everyday needs of the occupied population. So it was a very heartwarming story. It encourages Americans to think that with some sympathy and understanding of basic human needs, and in this case, what the townsfolk of Adano most want, apparently, is a new church bell, that Americans will be able to create a positive new foundation for an American-led world order.
Right. So the original bell for the town was taken by Mussolini's forces in order to use melt down for armaments. And so basically they're saying that the heart of the town of the, has been taken, and the, and this captain, I think, who has to come in, and he has Sicilian roots himself, has to find a way to bring a find a bell for the town, even though it's not regular army. And but the you say that the book is kind of dark, actually, because we're seeing the regular army versus civilian rule, and how you have to deal directly with the people and try to listen to their needs. And even though it may not sound logical, this is what they want, and you want to help them. And but the, in the end, it's the army wins. I mean, I don't know if they demote the captain, but they certainly he's robbed of his command.
Well, the central dramatic pivot in the novel is a confrontation between the Italian-American. He's actually a major, and he's called Victor Droppolo. And, of course, it's very telling that Hersey would call him Victor as his first name. And he has a nemesis who is called in the novel General Marvin. But everyone who read the novel at the time was under no illusion about the fact that this character was quite obviously General Patton. And so Hersey, in the guise of fiction, was able to divulge some things which we now know as fact about Patton's intemperance, his sort of furious attempts to try to keep Sicilian mule-drawn carts off the roads and so on. I mean, if you've seen the biopic about Patton, you will perhaps remember a scene where he has a mule shot who's holding up the flow of American military traffic. So Hersey really wanted to dramatize a debate that had been going on in FDR's cabinet and more broadly in American wartime society about who exactly would be responsible for reordering societies in the aftermath of war. And of course, many civilians thought that civilian agencies ought to be undertaking that work. But there really wasn't any civilian agency, even though UNRWA, the United Nations Relief and Rehabilitation Agency, was in the pipeline. It didn't yet exist. And there wasn't any civilian organization that was in a position to say, well, you know, we'll be the ones who rebuild shattered infrastructure, who pacify populations, who deliver food and aid and so on. So necessarily, the work of occupation or military government, as it was often called, fell to the army. And not everyone in the army particularly wanted that mission, and that's a large part of the story that my book explores. But even within the army, there were suddenly some officers who were trained at a special school which was set up at the University of Virginia to undertake the work of occupation. And they, like Hersey's hero, Major Droppolo, tended to bring a more civilian sensibility to bear. So whereas the Patton character emphasizes military necessity, even if that means shooting the mules in Sicily, the Droppolo character says, no, we have to listen, we have to figure out what it really is, including their spiritual aspirations that we might be able to best meet.
And there are all sorts of, but it's still sort of an idyllic telling of what the occupation would be like, because we're not really dealing with the ideological issues of a population and re-educating them, like rejecting fascism or Nazism, and also black market issues and sex trafficking, which seems to happen quite a bit, and rape, which happens during occupation all the time. Was the good occupation, was it really as good as all that? We're going to talk about that when we come back from this break. Our phone lines are open. The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. The Good Occupation, American Soldiers and the Hazards of Peace. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. After World War II, the fighting was over, but now the fighting force quickly was recast into an occupation force in Europe and in Japan. This was a new role for GIs, and it proved to be just as difficult and perilous sometimes as fighting the war. We're joined by the author, Susan Carruthers. Her book is The Good Occupation, American Soldiers and the Hazards of Peace. So earlier we were talking about the film film and the book, A Bell for Adano. But there's another movie that kind of tells the occupation Europe story, which is The Third Man, Orson Welles' Joseph Cotten movie. And we see a more nefarious side of things, black market, crime, and prostitution and things like that. Is that a more accurate depiction of what the American occupation was?
Well, I think we have to bear in mind that the occupation looked rather different in different places. But I do think that the sort of gritty texture, the multiple shades of gray that The Third Man conjures for viewers, and this was based on a novella by Graham Greene, offers a sort of textured account that would certainly have resonated with more of the men and women whose letters and diaries I read as I researched the book, were writing in their self-understandings of what occupation was about. So their letters home, their diaries are full of sometimes quite anguished reflections on the rather sordid and transactional nature of dealings in occupied territory. Because, of course, Americans enjoyed a complete monopoly over armed force. They were quickly disarmed their Axis enemies. And they were, for an army in World War II, they were remarkably well provisioned. And quickly after the war, they became even better provisioned with lavishly stocked PXs and so on. So if you imagine a situation in which you have a sort of hungry and often desperate population, eager to trade whatever personal items they might have to just, you know, get the next meal on the table and so on, or indeed to sell their bodies in order to be able to put food in their children's mouths, the occupational politics often had a much bleaker and more sordid kind of aspect to it.
You don't rebuild an economy by giving away food for free, but you're dealing with the fact that there are so many people who are hungry and impoverished, and you have to worry about the encroachment of communism appealing to the hungry. So how do they deal with that?
Well, it's interesting that you talk about the appeal of communism. I mean, we tend to associate the onset of the Cold War with a little bit later, 47, 48, rather than the immediate aftermath of the war. But really, as soon as Americans in some places, in particular, of course, in Germany or Korea, where the country was partitioned and divided partly by Americans and partly by Soviets, they tended to have often quite conflictual encounters with one another, and certainly different understandings of what occupation would look like, which post-fascist elements in those societies ought to be empowered in Germany and elsewhere. But in the end, I think, without too much time elapsing, I think Americans do come to a realization that they're not going to preside over the starvation of enemy populations. And that was certainly a very dominant theme that I found in letters written back from Germany over the first winter after the war, 1945-46, of American officers, sometimes enlisted men, becoming increasingly anxious about the state of the German population and fearful of the fact that they were going to have to find better ways of distributing food to fend off the demoralization, and as you say, perhaps also fend off the alternative model that's being offered just across the divisional zone in eastern Germany or in part of Berlin.
Let's go to the phones now. The number is 210-614-8980. If you were part of the Good Occupation, American Soldiers and the Hazards of Peace, would like to hear your story. Claiborne is on the line. Claiborne, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Well, this book points out the exact difference between what we did in Germany and Japan in World War II and what we did in Iraq, to wit, especially because we had most of the country was conscripted, so you had people from all professions and walks of life. But anyway, we went in and we put American officers and NCOs in charge of existing structures and then tried to transform them, as opposed to we went into Iraq, we blew up their governmental infrastructure, and then we let things fester. You know, it was after 6 months without food and water when things started to go really south in Iraq, which goes back to the tension between trigger pullers like General Patton, who's focused on the mission of defeating the enemy as opposed to stuff that to him was non sequitur, because all he was focused on was defeating the enemy, whereas other people were focused on what do we do with the population once we own it and how do we transform them.
All right, Claiborne, thank you for the call. So we know that in Iraq we had this de-bathification that went on, but when Patton was part of the occupation, he kept Nazi officials in places of government because they could keep services running. So was that the lesson to be learned?
Well, Patton was demoted, and he died quite soon thereafter after a car accident, precisely because he had seemed to belittle the project of denazification, which other officers clearly were keen to take more seriously. But in his part of Germany, in Bavaria, he had, as you say, empowered some people who'd been prominently involved in the Nazi Party. So Patton's strident voice, of course, is no longer on the scene after late 1945. And there's a lot of debate about how far denazification went, how far it should have gone. But certainly at the outset, the intention was to remove key party players in Germany. But of course, Germany, as historians pointed out in 2003, after years of ruinous total war and after complete and utterly convincing defeat was not like Iraq in 2003 in any way. And your caller is also quite right that the composition of the army is very, very different. So in Germany, you have millions of young men and, of course, women in the WACs who are from every walk of life. They have a very different attitude towards soldiering and their interactions with the population. And in Japan, things look a bit different because the two countries, the two predominant Axis powers, received really quite markedly different treatment. So in Japan, this was it was left far more to the Japanese government structures to carry on their existing work, albeit under the intense supervision of the Supreme Commander of Allied Powers. So this is MacArthur and his people. And the emperor, as we know, of course, stays in place, and that was its own controversial decision.
Yeah, there's a lot more animosity about how to treat Japan after the surrender. That may be due to the fact that of the attack on Pearl Harbor, which, you know, Germany never got a whack at the continental United States or, you know, the United States proper.
Well, I think it's worth bearing in mind because this is so easily forgotten when we look at films like A Belfortano, which is set in Sicily, so not quite Axis territory proper, if you want to imagine it as being distanced. Or if we look at more fantastical projections of occupation like Tea House of the August Moon, which is set in Okinawa. I mean, as time has gone by, I think we've arrived at ever rosier notions of occupation through these stories of romantic reconciliation. But the critical thing that I would urge us to remember is that when American forces occupied Germany and Japan, they really had a punitive mission to denazify, deindustrialize, demilitarize these enemies, and do the equivalent things in Japan to make sure that these countries could not ever again go to war. And particularly with regard to Germany, there was a sense that the occupation that had followed the end of World War I had been a failure, quite self-evidently so, or Allied troops wouldn't have been fighting against Germans again in the space of just one generation. And I think you're right also to point out that the occupation of Japan is shaded by the particular animus that attaches to that country because it had indeed attacked the United States at Pearl Harbor. And, of course, the character of the war in the Pacific is racialized in a way that the war in Europe against Nazi Germany isn't.
So in reading the letters of the GIs, I mean, are many of them wondering, why am I still here? I signed up to fight the war. The war is over. I want to go home.
Absolutely. I mean, this is probably the loudest theme that cries out from many of the letters, particularly from enlisted men, but also from some officers as well, that their indoctrination before they went in, if they received any indoctrination at all, had warned them to expect resistance. And that was a particularly powerful fear with regard to Germany. And many of the senior American officers expected that there would be armed sabotage and that there would be a last redoubt, and a sort of guerrilla organization called the Werewolves was poised to launch this sort of ongoing war of sabotage against the Allied occupation forces. They really did expect this to happen. And lo and behold, although Germans are often understood to be rather sullen and truculent in the face of occupation, there is very little armed resistance and certainly nothing that approximates the wholesale campaign of sabotage that they have expected. Likewise, in Japan, Japanese people seem thoroughly cowed. I mean, in the state of abjection after long, long years of a ruinous war, even longer in Japan, bearing in mind that their war in Manchuria begins in the 1930s. It's been tremendous rationing, so many of the Americans are just struck by how incredibly poor the Japanese are, that many of the men are just wandering around in tattered uniforms. They don't have civilian clothing to change back into. But no one seems to be rebelling, and of course that fuels precisely the sentiment that you point to, which is of millions of Americans thinking that when the war ends, they get to go home. That in many cases was really the motivating force to keep fighting, was the idea that one day this ends, and when VE or VJ Day has happened, we get to go back again. So what you found in the latter months of 1945 was mounting frustration, anger, rage, and political activism.
Okay, Susan, I've got to go. We're out of time.
Okay.
Amazing story. Susan Crothers is the author of The Good Occupation, American Soldiers and the Hazards of Peace. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thanks for tuning us in.